in our program of topological phases and quantum computation we thought it would be useful also because of the way the group of people was composed to actually try to give some very elementary lectures on the material that will be the basis and is assumed to be known by everybody, but we think that not everybody shares the same basic knowledges here. So that was the idea behind it. And I don't know, this is these type of pictures, a lot of people will be very unhappy about it. But anyway, if I make a very rough picture, you could say, well, this whole subject has an experimental branch, which is, of course, still hopefully growing with experiments in quantum Hall, ion traps, Josephson junction networks. And then the other extreme side, you could say there's just quantum informatics as a rather formal formal theory of information with all kinds of its own problems. And of course, we have people here from that branch. From this branch, we will have some talks during the program. We have invited a number of people who are representatives of these particular types of experiments. And of course, in theory, we are here at the bottom with a lot of people. Varying from real condensed matter people here, very close to closer to the experiment, further away, people, experts in conformal field theory, topological field theory, all kinds of lattice versions of these things, and then we get to a more mathematical side, which is so many things that I don't even know how to compactify that in a little blob there, but of course that is also interacting. So you can draw thousands of arrows here if you want. And so the idea was that we should kind of try to have some introductory lectures. Now, these lectures should be on the blackboard, of course, so I'm violating one of the rules already. So, also the duration of these lectures is not quite sure. Normally lectures have 2 times 3/4 of an hour, and we'll see what we'll do today. We have already thought that we should have, I was trying to talk about very elementary ideas about what an anion is and what you can think of, and then leading up to some algebraic properties. Next week we will have more something that also touches on conformal field theory and fractional quantum Hall effect, and Joost Slingeland will give a lecture on that. So for many of the people, this is all very well known. I mean, this is the problem with introductory lectures. And then we thought we would move on to a more formal discussion of these types of theories, and Wang will give a lecture. Then we will have maybe the lattice models discussed by Mike Friedman and so forth. I mean, so we want to go on and make sure that we also hit on these kind of aspects. So that's the idea, and I hope you will be here, and many others, maybe students or something, but we weren't quite sure who would show up. This is another picture of the theoretical battlefield. You could say this is a little bit from above. We have all these fundamental theories, Einstein gravity gauge theories, and string theory, trying to bridge the gap there with even more elaborate things to the side. And of course, if you look at lower dimensions, we have nice problems like 2+1 dimensional gravity. If you do this all in 2+1 dimensions, you get to Chern-Simons theory, certain discrete gauge theories. And here are at once what we lots of topological features in the theories we are left with. And you could say under that or with that, there are many, many other fields that connect up to these subjects. So I don't know which arrows to draw. But at one hand, we have of course all these developments in condensed matter theory using conformal field theory. I think of quantum Hall systems, Bose-Einstein, and on the other side, in more in the statistical mechanics, all kinds of lattice models, lattice systems, integrable systems, critical phenomena, etc. And of course, in the interface of all these things, we may talk about things like anions, topological phases, and leading to hopefully quantum computation. So I was just very modest, and we talk about what I think about topological interactions, abelian flux charge composites, the notion of anions, non-abelian types of anions in the most simple way. So I, as you see here, I will not talk about conformal field theory too much today. I will instead talk about simpler models where you realize these things, like discrete gauge theories, with examples in lattices. And then I will get to this more Hopf algebraic language, which seems to be the suitable language to discuss lots of the most fundamental properties, which we have to use if we want to do more of the formal aspects of quantum computation. And maybe I will talk about breaking some of these symmetries. Maybe not. Okay, well, this is too simple, but this is a non-contractible loop in conversation space, and you sit in a circle. This is what we do in kindergarten in Holland. You set the children and you say, silent, you say, your mother died or mother died, and they have to tell it to the next person. So there are local interactions and you end up somewhere else, and you see the message has been deformed. So if they ever ask me to explain quantum mechanics to in kindergarten, this would be the experiment. Put a wall here, two slits, and you get pretty much destructive interference without much problems there. So the idea of the perfect messengers, they are there, but still, even if they carry the messages perfect, we all know it will not work out always the right way. And here we have the example where there is a deficit angle, but of course, if we disturb the orbit a little bit, then the deficit angle will be different, and that's not what we want. This is already better. You have a more localized source here, or singularity if you want, and if you here just follow the wind, then at least it doesn't matter that much where you walk, you will make about the same rotation. Here's yet another nice example. Yeah, Jan Zahner was already saying you are trying to sell all this Dutch art here. This is a nice, see, and there is this beautiful spot here in the middle where he presumably, nobody knows, didn't know how to resolve this problem. You see what happens, here is a guy, he looks at a painting, and in the painting, you can move around in the painting, and you come back here somewhere, and you see that in the painting, oh, and you walk in here, and you see that he is himself in the painting. So this is also a kind of a non-trivial parallel transport going on. And it's interesting how it is, kind of a non-trivial transformation going on there. You see, this is what he did in the center. Oh, it's I think it's his signature only there. Now here, this is the only sketch that was found, and you see how nice this happens. He is scaling up and rotating. If you go to the inside, it is rotating. So it is some kind of interesting map. And now there is this Dutch mathematician, Hendrik Lenstra. He's in Leiden, and he made a study of this painting. He's a well-known mathematician, actually, but he did this on the side. This is the only sketch that is found, and where you can see how he did this. So the idea is you deform. See, this is the work of Hendrik Lenstra, and I stole it from his site. Here's a beautiful site, and you can do it all and find it. And see, he found out, say, more or less what happened. You map here, you an exponential map, you rotate, and you scale. And then you map it back with the inverse, and then you get this picture. So you map this system to that system, which has pretty much the properties of the Escher. You see, here it is. Here's the Escher. Here are the other. You see, it's different because here you see the curves down, and here it curves up. Yeah. 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 He didn't know mathematics, and he was always a bit scared of mathematics. And No. And many mathematicians have gone to his place trying to explain what they had done with his paintings to, and then he would sit there kind of very uneasy, waiting until this person would leave because he wouldn't follow what was going on. So it's kind of interesting. But this is, of course, very nice. So Lenstra actually managed to resolve it. If you have the map, you can, of course, map all the points, and so he did it. You see, he resolved this puzzle here, and he found out how to continue. So he, in some sense, improved a little bit on the Escher picture.
You have to move it? Move?
Yeah, wait.
Oh, I see.
So you can, let's do this one. I hope it will work. Yeah. So instead of moving around, of course, you can also stand in your spot and then have the painting move around and scale and do everything it needs to do. Thought it was kind of a neat picture. Yeah, here you see it. Really beautiful. Yeah, it is a continuous motion, so you go around, so to speak. Yeah, yeah. Isn't that great? Well, this is about. Yeah, I mean. Yeah. No, you know what is neat? This is neat. Of course, there is also this story that the family of Escher is like all families of great artists, is just there for the money. So they're chasing everybody who's using Escher. And so this guy, Lenstra, is in big fights with the family, because imagine what he did. He did also the following. He said, well, I know one map, but there are, of course, many conformal maps. So let's make, you know, I mean, he can make Eschers, you know, you just vary the parameters, you know. You can get this, it's that way getting famous. And I don't think the family is very fond of this kind of stuff. Okay. This is how it all started, I think. This is, in many ways, a sound experiment. This is what I got in elementary school. They make the sound in here, and you have to put your ear there. And then they do this thing. And then, of course, you hear something or you hear nothing. And it's a simple rule there, of the wavelengths fitting on the lengths of the tubes, and get constructive or destructive interference. This, of course, many years later, we could do experiments like this, basically the same double slit type experiments. And of course, we have a similar condition. And now we have the nice thing that if we do this with electrons and we can couple it to a flux, then we can move this pattern up and down in this picture, I think, by changing the flux. And especially if you have the flux confined, then we all know what happens. Yeah, we are going further and further. It's all the same type of ideas of electrons moving, making constructive or destructive interference. And I hope we will get some talks in this workshop, we think so, on these recent developments. Here is another one. I think this is from the Delft group. Here is a qubit, and there is some measurement here made, and here are all these junctions. I can see it too clearly. Yet another one is this, what is called, what? Yes, it comes. I mean, I will talk about, this is just the idea of parallel transporting things around and getting in. But here we have already, these are already things that get very close to, well, very, I wouldn't think that would be possible so easily, but apparently these experiments are now done, Goldman et al., where they have two different whole states realized on one sample. So here there is a one-third filling fraction, and then they have a little island of two-fifths in the middle there. And so they can make interference measurements there of different types and of flux and charge composites there. So he will come and talk, I think, at a certain point. And so you can identify, at least measure, certain differences of charge and flux in these states. So what does it have to do with what I was trying to introduce? Was just the idea of an anion in its most simple sense. I have some kind of flux here. There is a field-free region here, and I carry the charge around, and we get the well-known Aron-Wohm phase factor IQ phi. Here we do it. And we can consider this, if we think of this as a composite, we can, of course, think of this as applying a rotation on this object of an angle 2 pi. And so we could identify this phase factor, say, with the spin of this composite object. And very naively, you could say, OK, there is a Q phi over 2 pi. And depending on Q and phi, we may be able to make this spin fractional. Sure, you could also look at composites. And I should maybe say that if you do it all more fancy, you go into field theory and you break it and you make a real flux tube and you add Chern Simonstrom, you can just find solutions which have these properties, and you can rotate them, and you find these particular phase factors. So it's naive, but you can certainly make it better. Here is another using the same idea. You have two different composites, and you can move those around. Q2 picks up the phase phi1, phi2, and Q1, and you get this type of property, which is, of course, if you take both of them the same, Q1 is phi1, Q1 is Q2, phi1 is phi2, then you could think of an interchange by taking a root, and there is a sign which is not quite clear, but you get, of course, a relation again between, say, the spin parameter and the statistical parameter. So you could imagine that in two dimensions, yes, these things are possible. There is a spin statistics connection, and you can have fractional charge, fractional spin. With the remark that if you do this little exercise I just did in three dimensions, of course, you can just tip over that picture to the plane and then continue it, and you see that the interchange here, the change t, is connected topologically the same as t minus 1. This is in three dimensions, but in two dimensions you cannot do this move, so not necessarily you have this relation which allows indeed for the fractional statistics properties. So that means that we have to deal with the celebrated braid group. In the plane we have rotations clockwise and anticlockwise, and we have to distinguish them. So there are different, there's a T and a T minus 1. And now if we think of these as just as particles for the moment, then we have to distinguish these two ways of twisting it. And furthermore, we get then a number. So that means that we have to think in terms of braids like this. We cannot just cross these lines. You have to say which one goes in front. Thinking of more strands, we have, of course, these generators, and we have certain relations, topological equivalences. The important relation here is the Young-Baxter relation, saying that if I have this picture, I can topologically deform it in that picture. And if we say it in the language of generators, T1, T2, T1 is T2, T1, T2. So we have, in principle, an infinite group, but we have to mod out this relation. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. This was in, at this level, yes. Here.
So that actually is always something like that, but you know, capable even of the two
pictures. The Young-Baxter equation comes up all over the place, of course, as a condition on whatever objects you are talking about. But in here, it is clear that I. Yeah, answer. I mean, this thing comes up, this relation comes up, yeah. For the statistics properties, this implies these following rules, of course. If we have T is T minus 1, we have T squared. We have in one-dimensional representations eigenvalues plus or minus 1, bosons, fermions. And if we are in two dimensions, we have this extended possibility. And if you have look again for one-dimensional solutions, you will find this possibility of e to the I theta, where theta is, for the moment, arbitrary, unitary representation. And these are, of course, the anions. We do not have any longer this relation, but if we look for larger representations of this this algebra, then of course we end up with talking about non-abelian anions. Sometimes we have situations where, you know, well, in the examples I will discuss, we will have extra relations like t to a certain power is fixed, is 1 or something like that. Well, anyway. I was saying I will have certain, the examples I was going to discuss, I say you will have another extra relation, like, for example, you have a finite group or something, then usually a certain power of braiding will end up being trivial again. That was what I meant. The other n has to do with the number of bn, you mean, of the number, yeah. Yeah, that would be the number of strands or the number of particles, that's right. This is 9, I don't know, it's a numbering of knots, and these are the number of passings, and then there are these inequivalent knots, which are classified, of course, by these braids. And yeah, it's just... right. I indicated that indeed you can think of these objects also making a rotation, and then you get a phase factor. So the natural thing is also to think of these anions, which I have now more or less introduced, as being a combination of a charge and a flux, a composite of the two, as a kind of a ribbon. I mean, the way I have talked about it, you could almost think of the charge and the flux sitting at opposite sides. There is then also a notion of an anti-anion, of course, with the opposite quantum numbers. And you can draw diagrams like this one. For example, you create an anion and an anti-anion, and you annihilate them again. And of course, you can twist them. You can make a rotation in between. That would be this picture here. And you can connect up again. You can move this to the other side, for example, showing you that if you assume that there are particles and antiparticles, or anions and anti-anions, that spin of the two would be the same. And you can also use these diagrams to relate spin and statistics in a rather explicit way. So here you have two of these pairs. You interchange the pairs. And then you can topologically look what you have done, and you will see that the whole state is basically rotated by a 2 pi here, or at the left-hand side or at the right-hand side. And so you can just do this indeed with a ribbon, there is no problem. So the effect of the interchange is equivalent to a 2 pi rotation. Let me say very few things about this. This is, of course, the theory which is closely related to all these knots or these oriented manifolds, where you can define a three-dimensional surface and you define an action in terms of what you would think are what are sort kind of gauge fields. Now this action is has an enormous invariance on the topological deformations, just not just gauge transformations, and thereby this theory will have it looks like a local theory, but it has in fact only very few degrees of freedom, and the Hilbert space has in some kind of finite dimensional, is finite dimensional. These models have been written down and are classified And it's a kind of complicated stuff, but they are classified in principle by this sorry? You see that the, that was probably what I was trying to make that point. In this theory, you see indeed that if you write down the equation here, the field equation, you will see that it is in a sense algebraic. It just says that the field is zero except if I have sources. If I couple sources to it and say this is the electric charge density, would be equal in the classical sense to the magnetic field. So here you have a very natural theory to implement, coupling charge and flux together. So you get here indeed charge and flux composites, and depending on the parameters in this theory and this coupling, you will see that you can make different charge and flux composites. So these are in fact the equations of an incompressible whole fluid, so to speak. So it is true that the whole systems will effectively be described by these Chern-Simons theories. So that is important. You mean the level in the gauge group? There is, I was planning to talk only about, say, situations for finite groups, and then this classification scheme boils down to something like the. These are group cohomology things, so there is this is the most general way in which you classify these Chern-Simons theories. And I don't know, I think one of us will talk about this later, maybe Wang will explain these general classification things. Here, for this discrete group, so H is now a discrete, maybe non-abelian group, the classification boils down to the third cohomology group of H itself, these coefficients in U1. It's a three co-cycle, and so it is a map of three group elements in U1, and modulo, co-boundaries or something of that sort. It is a classification given by for the discrete groups by Witten and Dijkgraaf, I think. And if you look, for example, for the abelian groups, then this third cohomology group here, for example, I take a group Zn, so a cyclic group, order n, and I take k copies of them, and I have an abelian group. Interestingly enough, you will find that these three co-cycles have the following structure: Zn to the power k plus a half k times k minus 1 plus 1/6 k times k minus 1 times k minus 2. And if we think of an abelian theory to start off with, then we know very well how to make these first two. I think it is not it's probably done. I don't know explicitly the answer to that. We have done it for a few, but I don't know of any lists say where they are. It's a cohomology group, and this is. Yeah, H is here the gauge group, sorry, yeah. These are the coefficients in these general expressions. So you could do it in Z, but in this case it's U1. So this is the group structure you have in this cohomology group. And these should be realized as for example, Stern-Simon theories with, I was interested in trying to do this in abelian theories, and because a lot of the applications are using these abelian models. The first type is typically where you have AI and FI, so you have N copies of, or K copies of these U1s. You can embed this this abelian H group in this UN, in this U1, and you will find that this is typically the first K possibilities. If I have K, then there are K terms here. Then there are the half K times K minus 1. These would be typically this type of structure, with one A in one group and F in the other group. And then, of course, there is these, there is a third category of these. Oops. There is a type which is non-abelian. So these things are worked out, but you cannot fit it into an abelian theory. So we didn't understand, say, how you can realize it. You can, of course, realize it on a lattice, presumably, but in the continuum theory, it was not very clear how you could get this type of structure out. What we did is we analyzed the whole algebraic structure and found out that actually it's dual to a non-abelian group. So it is an essentially non-abelian theory there. Right. Well, yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, I said they should be, let's see, symmetric? Let's see. Or anti-symmetric, one of the two, I guess. Because you can partially integrate it. Okay. Well, if you part, this is just a U1 times U1 or something. Yeah, that's this part, so to speak. But then you can also have cross terms in that. Yeah. Yeah, I understand. Yeah, that should give you some additional constraints here. No, it's not. Well, it's as said, then you can still do various things. You have these, it's classified by the cohomology, the third cohomology, and you can find out what it is for these abelian groups. Well, but the question was, can I write down Lagrangians corresponding to all those different models which I find from the classification? And the answer was, I can, for example, do these guys, I can just embed them, so to speak, in an abelian Stern-Simon theory, except for this last category. There is essentially a non-abelian structure, so you cannot simply embed it in while we started off with Zn to the power k, you cannot write it down in terms of an abelian model in this way. The discreteness of the gauge group here has to, well, maybe I'm running ahead a little bit. The way to do it here would be to couple this theory, because we have charges, we have currents coupled to this model, and then we can, for example, break on the side of the, we can break the gauge invariance of this model by a Higgs mechanism to a discrete group, and then what we would be left with effectively would be a discrete gauge theory. That is the way we have done it. But presumably you can also define it directly in terms of, well, on a lattice or something of that sort, where you just restrict yourself to links being in the discrete group immediately. But then I don't know how to do this guy. Well, of course we can do you can do all kinds of things. You can add to this Chern-Simons, you can, of course, add real dynamical, you can make this with dynamical fields and add such an interaction term. You can also couple it only to currents, then this field will only be a statistical field and only give the anionic properties and will not have propagating modes. Or you can therefore couple it to all kinds of things. You can have just the Yang-Mills-Higgs theory, and that was what I was going to talk about, where you may or may not even couple these Chern-Simons theory to it. In what I'm going to say, these are not so important at this moment. I was just mentioning them because, of course, for the conformal field theory and other applications, it's a very important ingredient. So I was trying to get away from the abelian situation and try to give you an idea of what happens if things become non-abelian. And I was trying to convey this by some analogies. Here we have, for example, this is what is called a liquid crystal of a well-known sort. It's also known, if you have a local gauge theory, as the Alice electrodynamics theory. We think of a continuous gauge group here, J is SO3, broken down to, you see, these rods are like the order parameters, so there is some kind of symmetric tensor there. And we break down to basically the group U1, which is the rotations around, say, the z-axis, around the rods. And then there's also the discrete transformations where the rods are flipped or rotations over pi on any axis perpendicular to this vertical axis. So, I was using this program. I didn't have, this would be a semi-direct product. You see this Z2, these two elements do not commute, obviously. And so if I make that rotation by pi, then the U1 will be reversed, the generator. If it would be a vector, it would be turning around. So the generator of this U1 here will be reversed by this Z2. So the unbroken group has a discrete component, which means that there is also so if we break, we have, of course, also little modes there. We have Goldstone modes, two of them. Let me make sure that also the rotations around the x's move, here they are. And the rotation around the z, the y-axis move along the x-axis. These are the Goldstone modes, and I need them later. And of course the theory has a discrete element, so there will be a z2 flux or a z2 defect. I've drawn it here, and I've drawn, because that makes it more visible, that this is indeed possible and consistent in with such an order parameter field. Now, one aspect of the non-abelianness here is, of course, that there is now a You can think of the frame here. If you follow this field, then it will be dragged around and it will be turned over like here. So the frame gets rotated, in fact, by an angle pi around the x-axis, and that is the way this defect is defined, by this rotation angle pi around the x-axis. So if you now look what happens to the modes, of course the modes will, if you follow the modes here, they would maybe go and be, can be moved around, then you will see that there are two things. The ny, which is the rotation generated by tx, it will just be invariant. You can say this motion here is the same as there, so if I bring it around, that means that this mode is not changed, which means that indeed there is a way in the presence of this object to globally define this mode or this quantum number associated with this mode. If we look at the ny fluctuations here, or the nx fluctuations which are generated by the rotations around the y-axis, then you see, if you bring it around, that it will actually be, and you bring them together, that it will have changed sign. It will have gone to its negative. Which really means that you cannot globally define this ty as a generator anymore. And so this mode would, in some sense, if you could do all these things, this would therefore have some non-trivial phase factor. If you bring it around, and you could think even of doing experiments where you maybe would do interference of some sort. But the more important part here is that in the presence of this defect, this mode cannot be sitting, can be not globally defined, and therefore it cannot be brought, say, onto this defect. So in this, if we want to define global sectors of the theory, then it is now clear that this, having this defect here, we cannot define charges with respect to generators which do not commute with the defining property of the defect. So another way to say it, only the things that commute this, the quantum number of the defect, which is this rotation of pi around the x-axis, can be globally defined in that sector. That is important. So the presence of the defect gives an obstruction to global implementation of certain symmetries. And we know that that happens in many parts. It's also true, like in monopole physics there, we have seen. You would maybe expect that the unbroken group would be fully realized or as modes on a defect, but here you see that cannot be done. There is an obstruction for a certain part of the symmetry group. Okay, so we have seen what modes can do with a particular flux or a particular defect of some sort. And let us now go to lattices to go one step further and look at the fluxes themselves. They can also have non-trivial relations. So here are lattices, maybe with internal degrees of freedom and certain discrete symmetries characterizing them. Let's look at the situation where we have a Euclidean group and we have some lattice, and we get, of course, a lattice group. So first we have the full Euclidean group here with translations A and rotations, and we have a product rule for elements. Here it is, R1, R2. And A1 is not added to A2, but because A2 will be rotated by R1 if there is a non-trivial one. So this is the composition rule. Now, the lattice group will, in general, be some discrete group. So here is an example of a square lattice in two dimensions. I take it now for the moment here for Z4. This is again semi-direct C cross C. These are just the translations along the lattice. So if you have this, you will have certain Goldstone modes, which are phonons, typically, and they are associated with the generators which are broken. And there will be also defects, which are now P1 G over H, just labeled by the elements of the group. So the group H classifies the point defects. So there are usually, theoretically, there are six possibilities. Of course, we have three translations in three dimensions around x, y, and z, and three rotational axes, x, y, and z. I don't say that they can all be realized, but as real defects in a physical sense, but this is at least the classification. So if you go to two dimensions, we only have two dislocations, two translational defects, and one rotational defect type. And now, let's see, let me define them. Here is the translational defect. Here you see it sitting. There's one line missing here. So if we do it here, we will find, we step around it, we step around this point, make four steps. Then we have a defect, and that defect is characterized by this translation factor. So it is a translational defect, and that's called the Burgess factor, and that characterizes that thing. So that is indeed a group element. It is just a group element 1A, where A is this translation over a lattice factor. Here we have a disclination or a rotational defect, and that's of course defined with respect with a vector. We carry a vector around counterclockwise, and we see that if we define it locally to the frame, we bring it back, then there is this defect angle, and that defect angle is here 90 degrees or minus 90 degrees if we, it's clockwise, so minus pi over 2. So here we have two defects, and of course they are now, the defects are indeed associated with the group elements, and the group elements do in this case not commute. So we can ask the question, what does it mean to commute these defects then? Well, we can, for example, look here. We have a dislocation here with a missing line and it's defined by this Burgess factor here, and we can bring it, of course, around or half around in this particular case. And we see that if we have moved this guy in front of the disclination, then what happens here is that the disclination has effectively moved, because we have removed here one line. This is our base point from which we measure. It was at position 3, and now it will be at position 2. So what it did, we had 1A R0. There's an ordering. We have to define these defects by making a loop. And so we had first left 1A, the dislocation and the disclination to the right. We go through this little exercise here, and we see that if we have the dislocation on the right, then indeed the rotational defect has been moved by the element A, which we moved in front. The total of the whole thing is, of course, invariant, and that doesn't change. Do it the other way around. If you move this guy back in the back, so you can also see what happens if you bring it all the way around, you see what happens to the Burgess factor. It will just move and will be rotated. You see the defect will end up being rotated with respect to the defect here. It was here. Well, you can do it step by step and split the defect and so forth, but you end up with a defect which has been rotated. So that's what happens. You get 1A R0, you can just show that R0 is 1 R minus 1A. So the action of the rotation has worked. Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, I mean, people have, of course, tried to say, do elasticity theory and with defects in taking continuum limits of this sort. And I think Kleinert is one of the people who has been doing that already for a long time, and actually is quite successful. And you will find that this is very much like a if you just look at this, this is very much like a topological field theory of a discrete type I have discussed. So if you say it's two-dimensional gravity-like, then that is true. And you have, in that theory, if you put in sources, you can have sources for the torsion and for the curvature, and these would be exactly these guys. So yes, there is a clear analogy there. Yeah. So this is the more, now we can think of gauge theories, for example, with a continuous G, and we break it down to a discrete H group. Then we have fluxes, as I illustrated in the lattice, but you can also do it, of course, in a local theory. And we have here an element, we have a flux, so it's like an aprikosov type of solution. And we can take a charge around it, we can take a path around it, and we will get a phase vector, depending on the representation, of course. And we see that this will give us a group element now. This will be a group element, since it is an unbroken group H, it will be defined by a group element in the unbroken group, because we carry through the vacuum here, and the vacuum has to be single-valued, so this should be an element in the group H. So this is a group element. So we could characterize this charge by a group element, but then, of course, it's not invariant. We have not taken the trace here on purpose, because what we now can say is, well, there is still a global group acting here, say, at this point, and this path-ordered integral will transform like HA H minus 1. So it will be conjugated. This group element here will be under a gauge transformation in the unbroken group, will be conjugated. So this is a finite set of transformations we can do. And of course, these transforms define now a conjugacy class. So the remark here is, if we have a situation like this, we can discuss non-abelian fluxes, but these fluxes belong to some kind of multiplet. There is some vector space of, there are inequivalent things, and the basis of this vector space is given by these elements here, these conjugacy classes. So the group falls apart in conjugacy classes, and those are, well, multiplets of fluxes. That is the way I like to think about them. We have now the questions, because they are non-abelian, we have to be careful. If we combine the effects, we have to make sure that we do it the right way. For example, if this is A and this is B, we can, of course, connect these paths and deform it smoothly, and we get a fusion rule here, or fusion of these two defects, and sure enough, we'll in this order, it will be C is B times A, which is, of course, not anymore equal to A times B because it was non-abelian. So we have to be careful. What it means on the level of the classes should be clear. We can multiply now these classes, and we get here a class algebra. And so if we think of these as representations, this would be, say, the magnetic representations and the tensor product thereof. You see, because we want to associate states, we have to go, in some sense, to the class, to the group algebra, where the group elements themselves form a vector space, and you can add them and subtract them, and that is the idea here. Also, the question of interchange gets now interesting, because they are non-abelian, and as I showed in this lattice, you get the action of one group element on the other. And I think I demonstrated that already. You see it one more time. So you interchange them, and then they may change. So we define these as A prime and B prime after the interchange. So this is B prime, that's A prime. And if you now relate them, you do it careful. Up. And you want to know, you see B prime is just B. That's the same one. It has not been deformed. But now we have to read off what this means here. This was A, and A is now, in fact, only this. So it starts with B, then it starts with A prime, and you go back B minus 1. So the rule is that A is B minus 1 A prime B. So by interchanging them in the way indicated, indeed we get this conjugation by the element around which you move, so to say. And that was exactly what we saw in this simple lattice example I did before. So this is quite general. You get an action if you take one braid in this particular ordered way, then A prime is B A B minus 1. It's a group conjugation. Well, I know. And, well, there's many ways to see that. So So then it's interesting because we have now objects which in first are non-abelian fluxes, and you can move them around each other and thereby change their identity. That means in this case they stay in the same conjugacy class, so you move them around in the multiplet, you get another vector. And that is of course an interesting and important property, and it is very much a topological operation. So that is the way maybe to think already about the topological quantum computation in the most simple sense, where you associate with these vectors certain particles, and you take a bunch of them or not, and you start braiding them, and you get actions on these multiparticle states, which if you take the group large enough, may be enough to generate a general universal quantum gate. That's of course the purpose of this. So the question is then of course who that works. So I said already a few relations. We have the simple braid relations I indicated, and but we have now also the fusions and the braids. So this we did already. We get also consistency. You get further consistency relations because you have now fusions and braiding, so you get a consistency relation which is basically a triangularity relation, it is called a quasi-triangularity relation, where you want the topological equivalence of this to be true, and of course here you have a different operation, so these should be equal. Another thing is which is of course something that you want at this level is an associativity of the fusion product. So if I take A times B is C, A times B times C, then I first can fuse A and B, and then the combination here, I could A, B, and then the combined product fuse it with C, and here I do it the other way, first B, C, and then fuse it with A. And these are all in the three particle vector space of three particles, and so there should be a relation here. You should be able to expand each vector here in this basis, as you could call it. So this is another equivalence relation, and these are called the F coefficients in this expansion. It has, of course, many indices which label all kinds of details of this graph. Yeah, then you can go on once you have more consistency relations. For example, on these Fs, you have the famous pentagon relation, which you see involves just doing these simple associativity of the fusion product. So you use that rule, F here, B gets changed to C, here again, we do it on this one, we go to D, etc. You can go in both, you can go in independent ways and end up with the same guy. So that is a relation on these F coefficients. So the associativity is further restricted there. And then there's another important relation which involves the combination of braidings and braidings R and fusions, F matrices. And well, this is called the hexagon relation, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and here again are two paths by which you get the same result, and it involves braiding here. See, here you braid these two, and here's the F, that is the associativity rule, and so forth. So these, what is shown is that if you satisfy these relations, then the whole algebraic picture is consistent. It's also true that if we have the non-abelian situations, of course, in physical sense, nothing forbids you to move these fluxes and push them through each other, like, for example, here. So then you do not respect, say, this topological idea that you do not cross. But if you do it, then you will have to fuse somehow here, and you will get, of course, fluxes connecting. So you can expect also connected networks of fluxes in higher dimensions. So then the idea is that if you want to, I have now just sketched a number of these properties. I have sketched that there would be electric charges or certain charges. If I have defects, then there is an obstruction to maybe realizing the full unbroken group in such a sector. So the question is, is there some notion of symmetry or some notion of an algebraic underlying structure in this theory, which takes care of both the electric degrees of freedom and the magnetic or the flux degrees of freedom? And the answer is yes. It is one of those what is called a quantum double of that particular discrete group, and that's an example of a Hopf algebra, and that's a rather general notion, and it features in all the models that we are discussing basically for quantum computation, not the doubles, but these Hopf algebras. So. Yeah, what I therefore wanted to do is to emphasize now only that aspect of having the rules of the game with, for example, these non-abelian anions, which were generated by this discrete gauge theory. But of course, if you look at conformal field theories, then these Hopf algebras show up also. I mean, then you may have a chiral algebra with all the conformal representations, the modules of that chiral algebra, and if you fuse those, then you will find that these rules, these fusion rules and these certain braiding properties are also governed by one of such Hopf algebras. And so you could say that a lot of the questions we have with quantum computation can maybe be answered on the level of these quantum groups associated with certain conformal groups. So in the next lecture, Joost will talk about conformal field theory, and he will of course connect these things. Here we don't do that yet. We don't, in this theory, there's formal invariance and we don't need it, and yet this algebraic structure is present. So in some sense you could say it is quite robust. It doesn't need the conformal invariance, and that's why I like to emphasize this model a little bit. So you could also have maybe completely different realizations, after all, in nature, in two-dimensional quantum systems, where this is present, and while there is not all the conformal invariant. Huh? Yeah, here. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of, you could say I have less or more, I don't know what you would call it. I mean, it's less restrictive in that sense. So I have not added all kinds of degrees of freedom beyond this level.
Yeah, I would say more invariant than before.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, if, yeah.
You don't have to pay attention to cross ratios and things like that.
Sure. But in the conformal theory you will also find algebras of this type. So yeah. So the idea is yes, there is such a more extended notion of an algebraic framework there. And so I thought I would mention how that builds up. So here is what we started off with. We started off I take this particular example here of the group algebra, starting off with the group algebra. So this is basically a discussion of how a quantum double of a finite group is put together in some sense. And this was, of course, a general program of doubles coming from Drinfeld et al. So the idea was we have a group, here is the group, is the group product. An identity element which satisfies this property, and then naturally there is a co-algebra with a co-product, which is just stating that you tell how map from A to A cross A, so you know how the group say acts on tensor products, so that is trivial here, it's H cross H. There's also a co-unit which maps all. It's like the trivial representation, if you want to say it that way, or it is a trivial function. And the antipod is here, the inverse. Now, this whole thing makes, in fact, the Hopf algebra of this group. group algebra. So the group algebra having these properties is already a Hopf algebra. And having the group, then we can also look at the dual of that group, that is basically the functions, the set of functions on the group. If this is a discrete group, then this set of functions is a discrete set, and they are basically like projections. They are just delta functions, fi of x, sets just hi equal to the group element x, so it works on that way. And we can define a product rule here, and it's interesting, so that is the dual product of the functions, and it is defined using the co-multiplication on the other side, you see, because you have to have f1 and f2, so you have to know how you get x on these two factors, so that is going with this delta here. And the unit here is related with the co-unit there, and that's exactly the way it works. The delta star, the dual co-multiplication, you could say works on two elements here, and it does it by using the, you see, the product, the normal product. So these are all related diagonally here. And there is a kind of an inverse saying that S star F on X is just F of minus X to the minus 1. Now this is also again a Hopf algebra called A star, if you call this A, and now you can combine those, and that's how it's put together in this quantum double. A star A, and you can therefore write it as the double of H, which is FH, with a product here which is defined here, times the group algebra. And the basis elements could be the functions and the group elements, like here. There is now a product, which is, for the group elements, you see, you just get the group product, H1, H2, goes in H1 times H2. And the function part is interesting, because it's just, you see, it's not really, in that sense, tensor, a simple tensor, because here you get that the function, 1 takes the element x, but 2 moves this element x, conjugates its element x by h1. So that is, it's translated, so to say. So this is the multiplication rule. Well, there is a unit. Again, there is a co-multiplication using the product on the functions, and furthermore, the delta on the group. And so we can go on. Important here is that this, if you construct it this way, you can, well, it is a quasi-triangular Hopf algebra, as it is called, and it has these extra elements here. First of all, there is a ribbon element present in the theory, and that ribbon element is nothing but what we use to rotate by 2 pi, you could say. It's a central element, so you can label representations with it, is what physicists would say, and it is defined by the sum over H in this diagonal sense. And there is this matrix R, which is an element of A cross A, and it looks like this, you sum over all H. Functions times the identity here, times the unit and the group element. And that is a kind of canonical R matrix, which you have constructed this way. So you could also say that this is a program which produces R matrices which satisfy all these properties. So for the physicist, then, it would be very important to know the representation theory of such an algebraic structure. We have to go and drink tea, I think. Let me finish this, and then maybe stop, or let's then discuss what we do next. The representation theory is, of course, interesting of this stuff, and that's why we connect up with what we have said before. The representations are labeled here pi A alpha. What does it mean? A is indeed what I would call the magnetic label on the representation. It labels a conjugacy class. A labels the conjugacy class CA, and it is the orbit of some representative element HA, which is representative for that class. And alpha here labels something here. It labels a representation of this normalizer here of this element. So this is important. So here you see that the electric degrees of freedom indeed do not fall in representations of H, you first have to look what the magnetic sector is, then construct the normalizer, which commutes with HA, and then see, and then you have representations of that normalizer. So that's the way it fits together. A way to think of this is that this vector space VA alpha, on which this algebra can work, is in a map of group elements into a representation space of this normalizer, and with the following property. There is this kind of special property. You take an element X and you split it in, well, say in the coset element and an element in this NA, and you can take the NA element out, and then you have here a piece of the conjugacy class. So this is an effective way of describing these particular degrees of freedom. This is the way the group acts, and you see indeed the function uses this element to conjugate this group element here. So you see certain ingredients which were exactly the ones we needed before. The central element is working on, this is the ribbon element, so it's very nice. It gives you that representation associated with the magnetic flux, so to speak, and then you carry the electric thing around it. So this would be, say, what we would call the spin factor of this particular state, you could say. So here, that's very nice. So that is, the statistics factor, the spin factor. I define it here. And of course, we can also study tensor products because we have the co-multiplication. We can decompose these tensor products. We get Clebsch-Gordan rules and so forth. And we have the beautiful property that the Braid works on these tensor spaces. And there is then the question, is there still a spin statistics connection on the level here? The most important remark is that yes, the Braid matrix in working on an element of A cos A, here we have a delta, so here we have a group element. And what this here says is that the R matrix basically commutes with the group action here. And there's only that interchange of the two lines, but that we can correct by a simple interchange. So in fact, what it says here is that the Braid group elements commute with the group also. And that means that the n particle states in this language will decompose in representations, in a tensor product of representations of this quantum double group and the Braid group. So we can now multiply together all these representations, study their properties under the quantum double, and also find definite representations if you have n particles under Bn. And so then from this we can derive a generalization of the spin statistics theorem, which is basically this now. It's just that relation which was there, that we could, this is on the other side actually. We have delta, which is a fusion. Yeah, it's the opposite. I have it turning around. I don't know how that happened. This should be. So here we make two interchanges and have a fusion. And here we have rotations, etc., etc. So you could call it a suspenders diagram, because if you have a pair of suspenders, you can really do this once more and see that this is topologically equivalent. And so that's left what of a spin statistics theorem. It's not a property of the single particles, but it depends on in which channel they fuse, what their interchange properties are, and you have this phase factor associated with the fusion, the channel in which they fuse, that comes in this relation. So that is an important picture. Okay, I have talked already too long. Let me at least close it off here, and we can discuss if we do more later, but maybe it's enough. Because, of course, I had some nice examples here, but let's not do that. I did some very elementary things, I thought. I had a variety of defects, quasi-particles, and anionic composites. We had a consistent labeling of charged flux sectors. We had non-abelian fusion and braiding properties. We introduced quantum groups or Hopf algebras, which in these systems appear all over the place, and they provide the natural language in which ordinary electric and topological magnetic quantum numbers will appear on equal footing. That gives a very new possibilities also in other physical contexts. Multi-quasi particle representations of braid group generate non-abelian statistics. That's what I have been discussing, and I hope that if not all of you knew already all of this, then at least I hope it has been of some use. Thank you. Tea time.